This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the government of Malawi in July announced the 300% fee hike for university as a means to improve ailing standards of tertiary education in the country. But the students had protested the fee hike, saying many of them can't afford to pay.
That's Lamek Masina reporting from Blantyre. Details coming up.
Also, more than 3,000 Nigerians displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency are returning to their homes in Borno State. And top UN officials and experts warn that South Sudan may be heading towards genocide.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, a Nigerian army spokesman claims more than 3,000 Nigerians displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency are returning to their homes in Damasak in Borno State. Sani Usman has told reporters the government opened two roads in the region. This has enabled Nigerians to return home after seeking refugee status in recent years in neighboring Niger. Reuters says the Interior Minister of Niger has announced that several dozen Boko Haram fighters surrendered in the border town of Difa, Niger, after heavy fighting in Nigeria. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has also announced that Nigerian forces have overtaken a Boko Haram forest stronghold days earlier. In related news, the Associated Press reports that Nigerian authorities did not release 21 Chibok schoolgirls to visit their parents for Christmas, as was reported before the holidays. A government source says they are being held for their own safety in the home of a member of parliament in Abuja. The girls were among more than 300 kidnapped by Boko Haram in 2014. The Nigerian military has freed thousands held by Boko Haram, but Amnesty International says some have died under appalling conditions during their interrogation by Nigerian authorities. More than 2 million people have been displaced by the seven-year Boko Haram insurgency.
In Malawi, the clash between students and University of Malawi authorities over a recent hike in tuition fees shows no sign of ending. The university authority suspended studies at the Polytechnic, a constituent college at the University of Malawi, in July after the two sides failed to agree on when the students should start paying the newly introduced fees. Recent interventions by the courts failed to yield results. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The government of Malawi in July announced the 300% fee hike for university as a means to improve ailing standards of tertiary education in the country. But the students had protested the fee hike, saying many of them can't afford to pay. Some protests had resulted in running battles between the students and the police. They were trying to disperse the protesters who were destroying property and broke traffic with burning tires. However, the impasse was subdued after Chancellor of the University of Malawi, President Peter Mutharika, met with students' leaders at the State House in the capital, Lilongwe, in August. Mutharika proposed reducing the fee by nearly 5%, but the Polytechnic students have been refusing to start paying the revised fees. They say the rate increase is meant for 2016-2017 academic year, which they say is expected to start in November next year. The move has forced the university authorities to delay the reopening of the college until the issue is resolved. Frank Nchupuk is the president for the students' union at the Polytechnic.
For Polytechnic, we are starting the 2015-2016 academic year, which Chancellor College is also in the same academic year, and it has not been asked to pay this high fee because they are not yet in the 2016-2017 academic year where the fees that has been hiked is meant for. Unfortunately, we were asked to do that, and then we thought it was not justifiable.
In October, the students took the matter to the High Court, which ruled in favor of the students and ordered the institution to be reopened. But the university authorities appealed the ruling. In its decision in mid-December, the appeals court held the previous High Court ruling that the university students should be allowed to pay all fees until the start of the 2016-2017 academic year. But university authorities seem unfazed by the court ruling. Peter Mitunda is the spokesperson for the University of Malawi. He told VOA this week that he has no idea on when the institution will reopen.
I don't have a clue of it. As we were breaking for Christmas, I was in the village, so I didn't get some communication. But I know that by the time I was leaving last week, colleagues were meeting in Lilongwe. There was some good progress.
Mitunda said the university authorities are expected to meet again soon to discuss steps to take over the recent court's ruling on the matter. Students say the delay has affected their studies. Jason Blaula is one of them.
When you are a student, you plan for your academic life. You say by 2016, I'll have to graduate and go into the industry. And then the resources that you channel into your education, you also plan. But then when the college is not reopening as we possibly expected, a lot of things are disturbed. A five-year program is taking over 6 years.
Benedicto Kondowo is the executive director of the Civil Society Coalition for Quality Education, a local grouping that pushes for quality education in Malawi learning institutions. He says the ongoing impasse is detrimental to efforts to improve education in the country.
I would want the University Council to engage in constructive, sincere, and honest engagement so that some form of a compromise would be reached on this matter, because it is doing us more harm than good.
He said the current stalemate is causing more harm than good to the country's education sector. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Most of Zimbabwe's poor communities have seen an increase in underaged girls taking up prostitution to provide for themselves and their families. Kudzai Binavashi talks to social activists and sex workers about increased prostitution among young girls.
Prostitution is an illegal profession and is discouraged in the cultures of Zimbabwe. Yet the capital city, Harare, has seen a growing trend of women in the economically stressed high-density suburbs becoming sex workers, and many under the age of 18 years. Chakanetsa Ruzizo is a program manager for a pro-girl child support organization, Shamwari Mwanasikan. Ruzizo talks about the pressures that cause young girls to drop out of school to work on the streets.
So Shamwari Mwanasikan means the exclusive friend of the girl child. The economic situation in Zimbabwe, which is harsh, has been so unfair on the girl child in a number of ways. And a number of school dropouts for the girls is also on the increase, not only to issue of pregnancies, but also due to the issue of these economic hardships.
Eventually, these hardships build up and prostitution proves to be the only solution available for the majority of these impoverished girls. Ruzizo agrees.
The issue of food shortages itself, a number of girls are living in starvation, just like the same with the boys themselves. But the issue of starvation would now force these girls, once they would have hunger, they have starvation. Most of them are now resorting to prostitution, or they are being exploited to do commercial sex work.
Princess is 17 years old and works between Mbare, Harare's oldest high-density suburb, and the railroad just outside of Harare's business district. She talks about why she became a prostitute.
My name is Princess. I am a 17-year-old sex worker from Matavi in Mbare, and I work at the railway near town. I started working here last year in a bid to take care of my child, who's a year and 3 months old. A friend introduced me into this when I was in need of money, and she told me I could earn my own money.
Ruzito says the younger prostitutes find clients among industrial workers who walk to work along the railroad tracks.
Prostitution is also rampant in areas like Hopley, in areas like Epworth. Chitungiza itself is also another place where we have that issue. Again, in Sekerura, those are some of the places which are also having these issues of child prostitution. It's mostly in the high-density areas. That's where we are having that issue.
Angela Shoniwa works in Hopley, on the outskirts of Harare. She explains the increase in underage sex workers.
Sex workers are increasing mostly in our area, and it is largely because of the current state of our economy. Having a lot of child-headed families has not helped the situation, as they have had to take up prostitution to fend for their families.
There is not much money to be earned in prostitution, but Angela says young girls are still drawn to the trade by the failing national economy.
Short time.
Previously, for short time with a well-paying client, one would fetch $5. But now with the cash crisis, we are charging $2, and the juniors are even charging $1. Today, a well-paying client will pay $3 and $10 for a night, but in some cases, it's $7 and $10.
The Constitution of Zimbabwe offers legal protections to guard against child prostitution, but Ruzizo sees a different reality on the streets.
For instance, we were in Mumbai for the past 2 weeks. We found out that there is a place whereby the girls are now sexually exploited. These places are called Agosto, whereby the girls are exploited sexually so that there's someone who is paid for the services that they would render. The girls will be averaging an age of around 18, 12. Then someone would provide habitation for the sexual activities to occur. And it has got a number of law enforcement agencies who are also involved. So because of these economic hardships, which are causing rampant corruption among the law enforcement agencies, among the justice system itself, they are bringing the girl child to be vulnerable at the end of the day.
Ruzizo says not all girls choose prostitution to solve their financial difficulties.
The other issue now is for them to engage in early marriage. You hear of cases of girls who would actually go and become street beggars. And that's when the issues of prostitution also come in, and other exploitative measures like trafficking.
The girl child is at a great disadvantage in Zimbabwe's patriarchal society. Her plight has been worsened by the sorry state of Zimbabwe's economy. The future for many of the nation's girls looks bleak if the economic conditions don't improve soon. This is Kudza Iznawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Seventeen past the hour. You are listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Top UN officials and experts have warned that South Sudan may be heading towards genocide. This, if immediate concerted efforts are not put in place to pressure rival leaders of the world's newest nation to stop fighting. Leading human rights defenders at a recent forum held in Nairobi by Rift Valley Institute said, instability in South Sudan is threatening the region. The Institute is a non-profit think tank that operates in conflict-prone African countries. From the Kenyan capital, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking at the forum was John Prendergast, a renowned human rights activist and the founder of the Enough Project, an initiative to end genocide and crimes against humanity. He urged the new U.S. administration and the international community to send a top-level diplomat to push for renewed peace talks.
Critical deliberation should begin. The United States government should be talking with the Kenyan government and other IGAD states about what is possible in terms of an emergency crisis diplomacy. And that needs to be initiated immediately. We suggested back in Washington for an American audience that President Obama should name a very senior person who has bipartisan support so that there's Republican and Democrats buy-in who potentially could bridge the gap after January to the next administration.
Renewed fighting broke out in December 2013, just 2.5 years after the country gained independence from neighboring Sudan. The violence erupted when forces loyal to President Salva Kiir started battling those loyal to Riek Machar, his former vice president. Miss Priscilla Nyagoa Tut, a South Sudanese human rights campaigner with the Amnesty International, says negotiations aimed at brokering a peace deal have crumbled.
We might have a strong Secretary General, but if the Security Council states continue to politic the way they are around South Sudan, then there will be no progress. For instance, around the arms embargo vote, it was really African countries such as Angola and Senegal that was sitting on the fence and failing to, you know, give the U.S. the votes it needed to pass this very critical resolution on an arms embargo. So not only directing messages at the Secretary General, but the 15-member Security Council states, and even at the African Union level. This kind of politicking, and as the country descends into further chaos and fragments even further, such that there are bloodlines between who exactly is the SPLM opposition or who exactly are the rebels in the country right now.
Prendergast is a key expert who has focused on peace efforts in Africa for more than 30 years. He says a peace deal signed in August 2015, mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, has not stopped the fighting, which has killed tens of thousands of people and forced 3.1 million to flee their homes.
We need a much higher level effort. And there are different pieces. The national dialogue, or a national dialogue, a credible national dialogue, is something that probably has to happen much later. Certainly, the current idea of a dialogue that is controlled by the head of state, that makes no commitment about the results of that dialogue, having actually any impact on the situation on the ground, no commitment to implement those. We've seen this movie before, and it doesn't end well. So I would hope that the international community would not, including our new government, the new administration in Washington, wouldn't fall for this one.
The Nairobi meeting came shortly after the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed New Zealand lawmaker David Shearer as head of the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan. Philip Winter, co-founder of the Rift Valley Institute, which organized the debate, praised the new appointment.
He's been well briefed and he knows the difficulty of what he's taking on. And what I'd suggested to him is one of his first tasks is to rebuild the morale of a demoralized mission which has been unable to fulfill its mandate.
The Institute operates in South Sudan, including other conflict-prone countries in sub-Saharan Africa, such as Somalia, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In spite of the 2015 agreement, fighting has continued to devastate South Sudan, pushing the already struggling young country to the edge of famine, stalling development, and claiming lives. However, South Sudanese officials say the description of possible genocide is a bit far exaggerated and does not reflect the reality on the ground. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Two South African clothing designers are gaining stature for the excellence of their garments around Africa and the world. Husband and wife team Kaya and Bianca Sibia call their company Punk and Ivory, or Punk and Ivy. Through their innovative clothing, they say they want to reflect life in Africa. The Sibias believe Africans should be the ones selling themselves to the world in terms of the clothes they dress in. They say Punk and Ivy's mission is to create active streetwear tailored to the needs of urban Africans. Darren Taylor reports in part three of a series on people in South Africa handcrafting goods of exceptional quality.
The audience reacts at a recent fashion show in Johannesburg as models wearing Punk and Ivy's latest daring creations slink down the catwalk. Bianca Sabia shows off some of hers and her husband's latest designs. There's an olive blazer made from microfiber and decorated with the red and yellow heads of chickens. The lining on its pockets reflects Punk and Ivy's drive to experiment.
This is actually snakeskin. Then all that is essentially is just another way for us to be able to kind of customize and make it our own.
CBR says she was shocked to discover a few years ago that the so-called African prints used by most clothing designers on the continent are made in Europe and China. So she and her partner designed their own South African-made prints.
We try to kind of recreate and reimagine the idea of a camouflage. So it looks a lot like a lot of the different colored amoebas, all in berries and browns, cool kind of creams and the touches of black. And then we played a lot with burgundy.
Punk and Ivy's designs include khaki blazers with leather pockets and buttons, a maroon, white, blue and yellow patterned shirt, and a striking orange jersey.
It looks a bit like a sunset, actually. Camouflage with touches of burgundy. And I love the fact that we can play with stuff like this.
The Sabiha's clothes are handmade by local tailors according to each individual buyer's wishes.
Our clientele generally are males between the ages of 18 to 55. And we find that a lot of them enjoy having something made that is custom for them that only they own.
Although most customers are men, the firm's clothes are manufactured to be worn by all genders.
We like to work with garments that are androgynous, so we don't deal with frocks and dresses necessarily, but a woman can equally look great in a zip-up blazer as opposed to a man. So I think it was important for us to also kind of teach the young people and our consumer base that, you know, you don't necessarily have to stick to the traditions of what the major retailers are telling you to wear.
Sabiha says she's disappointed that Punk and Ivy isn't able to use locally made fabric because at the moment South Africa doesn't produce enough of it and most is imported. It does, however, use local leather. Sabiha says across the continent there's a swing towards dressing more African and to stop following European and American fashion trends.
People are very aware of the African economy and the power that it has. And it's important that we embrace that because if we don't help ourselves, then we can't keep looking to the East and West to try and fix our economies.
She wants to explore Africa more to learn from other designers.
I am planning to do a lot more travel into East and West Africa specifically. And it's not just for fabric sourcing. It's also just to understand what is definitive in terms of fashion.
Sabiha says Punk and Ivy has flipped the concept of the traditional clothing label on its head.
Everybody goes kind of the regular idea around being a designer. You come up with a collection, you establish a brand, and you start a retail space, and then that's kind of where it ends, essentially, you know. And we were like, well, it's all good and well to have a retail space, but how do people get access to you? So we started the idea of having a mobile space.
This the company achieved by creating Africa's first mobile boutique, taking its bespoke garments to more people at street markets, for example, using a 42-year-old Dodge motorhome imported from the United States.
It was almost 10 meters long. We were like, oh my God, that's perfect. Imagine what we could do in that space. So we literally bought the damn thing online, and by the time it landed here, it was a complete wreck. It was rotten beyond, but it had a really good engine.
But it remains an engine that's difficult to start.
It's a 1974 vehicle. It takes a good 30 minutes to warm up. It's like an old lady that needs like a panado and a cup of tea and a gin and tonic.
The Sabiha's refurbished the vehicle into their so-called motique. It's now their primary trade space, lined with mirrors, hanging space for their clothes and a change room. But with Punk and Ivy's growing international reputation, there's also plenty of space for their works at premier fashion shows.
Somehow we ended up becoming influencers for like the street-level youth space. You know, we're very much about Pan-Africanism, we're very much about expression, we're very much about elevating and reimagining Africa in whatever small way we can.
But the Sabiha's influence isn't small, and demand for their clothes from fashion capitals across Europe attests to that. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an encore showing of our program looking at the legacy of U.S. President Barack Obama. Join guest host Esther Githui Ewart and her panel as they examine President Obama's 2 terms as the U.S. Commander-in-Chief. the legacy of President Barack Obama on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.